fell foaming, and Gus bent to gather up the mess, then stopped, crouching, his hand on the soaked bag. The van listed ever so slightly. Its undercarriage springs pinged once. Something had moved or shifted inside. Gus straightened, leaving the burst beer on the ground and moving backward, shoes scraping the grit. A few steps away, he reset himself, willing himself to relax. His trick was to think that someone was watching him lose his cool. He turned and walked calmly to the closed garage door. The spring creaked again, putting a hitch in his step, but not halting him. He reached the black panel with a red plunger switch next to the door. He hit it with the heel of his hand, and nothing happened. He hit it two more times, first slow and easy, then hard and fast, the spring action on the plunger sticking, as though from disuse. The van creaked again, and Gus did not allow himself to look back. The garage door was made of faceless steel, no grip handles, nothing to pull. He kicked it once, and the thing barely rattled. Another bang from inside the van, almost answering his own, followed by a severe creak, and Gus rushed back to the plunger. He hit it again, rapid fire, and then a pulley whirred, and the motor clicked, and the chain started running. The door began lifting off the ground. Gus was outside before it was halfway up, scuttling up onto the sidewalk like a crab, and then quickly catching his breath. He turned and waited, watching the door open, hold there, and then go back down again. He made certain it closed tightly and that nothing emerged. Then he looked around, shaking off his nerves, checking his hat, and walked to the corner, guilty fast, wanting to put another block between him and the van. He crossed to Vesey Street and found himself standing before the Jersey barriers and construction fences surrounding the city block that had been the World Trade Center. It was all dug out now, the great basin, a gaping hole in the crooked streets of Lower Manhattan, with cranes and construction trucks building up the site again. Gus shook off his chill. He unfolded his phone at his ear.
"Felix, where you at, amigo?"
"On 9th, heading downtown. What's up?"
"Nothing. Just get here pronto. I've done something I need to forget about."
Isolation Ward, Jamaica Hospital Medical Center. Eve arrived at the Jamaica Hospital Medical Center fuming. "What do you mean they're gone?"
"Dr. Goodweather," said the administrator, "there was nothing we could do to compel them to remain here. I told you to post a guard to keep that Bolivar character's slimy lawyer out."
"We did post a guard, an actual police officer. He looked at the legal order and told us there was nothing he could do. And it wasn't the rock star's lawyer, it was Mrs. Lust's lawyer. Her firm. They went right over my head, right to the hospital board."
"Then why wasn't I told this?"
"We tried to get in touch with you. We called your contact." Eve whipped around. Jim Kent was standing with Nora. He looked stricken. He pulled out his phone and thumbed back through his calls.
"I don't see..."
He looked up apologetically. "Maybe it was those sunspots from the eclipse or something. I never got the calls."
"I got your voicemail," said the administrator.
He checked again.
"Wait, there were some calls I might have missed."
He looked up at Eve.
"With so much going on, Eve, I'm afraid I dropped the ball."
The news hollowed out Eve's rage. It was not at all like Jim to make any mistake whatsoever, especially at such a critical time. Eve stared at his trusted associate, his anger fizzling out into deep disappointment. "My four best shots at solving this thing just walked out that door."
"Not four," said the administrator behind him. "Only three."
Eve turned back to her.
"What do you mean?"
Inside the isolation ward, Captain Doyle Redfern sat on his bed, inside the plastic curtains. He looked haggard. His pale arms were resting on a pillow in his lap. The nurse said that he had declined all food, claiming stiffness in his throat and persistent nausea, and had rejected even tiny sips of water. The IV in his arm was keeping him hydrated. Eve and Nora stood with him, masked and gloved, eschewing full barrier protection.
"My union wants me out of here," said Redfern. "The airline industry policy is always blame pilot error, never the airline's fault, overscheduling, maintenance cutbacks. They're going to go after Captain Moldis on this one, no matter what. And me, maybe. But something doesn't feel right, inside. I don't feel like myself."
Eve said, "Your cooperation is critical."
I can't thank you enough for staying, except to say that we'll do everything in our power to get you healthy again. Redfern nodded, and Eve could tell that his neck was stiff. He probed the underside of his jaw, feeling for his lymph nodes, which were quite swollen. The pilot was definitely fighting off something, something related to the airplane deaths, or merely something he had picked up over the course of his travels. Redfern said, "Such a young aircraft, and an all-around beautiful machine. I just can't see it shutting down so completely. It's got to be sabotage. We've tested the oxygen mix and the water tanks, and both came back clean. Nothing to indicate why people died or why the plane went dark." Eve massaged the pilot's armpits, finding more jelly bean-sized lymph nodes there. "You still remember nothing about the landing?"
"Nothing. It's driving me crazy."
"Can you think of any reason the cockpit door would be unlocked?"
"None.
Completely against FAA regulations." Nora said, "Did you happen to spend any time up in the crew rest area?"
"The bunk?"
Redfern said.
"I did, yeah. Caught a few Z's over the Atlantic."
"Do you remember if you put the seat backs down?"
"They were already down. You need the legroom if you're stretching out up there. Why?"
Eve said, "You didn't see anything out of the ordinary?"
"Up there? Not a thing. What's to see?"
Eve stood back. "Do you know anything about a large cabinet loaded into the cargo area?" Captain Redfern shook his head, trying to puzzle it out.
"No idea, but it sounds like you're onto something."
"Not really. Still as baffled as you are." Eve crossed his arms. Nora had switched on her Luma light and was going over Redfern's arms with it. "Which is why your agreeing to stay is so critical right now. I want to run a full battery of tests on you." Captain Redfern watched the indigo light shine over his flesh. "If you think you could figure out what happened, I'll be your guinea pig." Eve nodded their appreciation. "When did you get this scar?" asked Nora.
"What scar?"
She was looking at his neck, the front of his throat. He tipped his head back so that she could touch the fine line that showed up deep blue under her luma. "Looks almost like a surgical incision." Redfern felt for himself.
"There's nothing."
Indeed, when she switched off the lamp, the line was all but invisible. She turned it back on and Eve examined the line, maybe a half inch across, a few millimeters thick. The tissue growth over the wound appeared quite recent. "We'll do some imaging later tonight. MRI should show us something." Redfern nodded, and Nora turned off her light wand. "You know, there is one other thing." Redfern hesitated, his airline pilot's confidence fading for a moment. "I do remember something, but it won't be of any use to you, I don't think." Eve shrugged almost imperceptibly. "We'll take anything you can give us."
"Well, when I blacked out, I dreamed of something, something very old."
The captain looked around almost ashamedly, then started talking in a very low voice.
"When I was a kid, at night, I used to sleep in this big bed in my grandmother's home. And every night at midnight, as the bells chimed in the church nearby, I used to see a thing come out from behind a big old armoire. Every night, without fail, it would poke out its black head and long arms and bony shoulders and stare at me."
"Stare?" asked Eve.
"It had a jagged mouth with thin black lips, and it would look at me and just smile."
Eve and Nora were both transfixed, the intimacy of the confession and its dreamlike tone both unexpected.
"And then I would start screaming, and my grandmother would turn on the light and take me to her bed. It went on for years. I called him Mr. Leech because his skin, that black skin, looked just like the engorged leeches we used to pick up in the nearby stream. Child psychiatrists looked at me and talked to me and called it night terrors and gave me reasons not to believe in him, but every night he came back. Every night I would sink under my pillows, hiding from him, but it was useless. I knew he was there in the room."
Redfern grimaced. "We moved out some years later, and my grandmother sold the armoire, and I never saw it again. Never dreamed of it again." Eve had listened carefully. "You'll have to excuse me, Captain, but what does this have to do with—"
"I'm coming to that," he said. "The only thing I remember between our descent and waking up here is that he came back, in my dreams. I saw him again, this Mr. Leech, and he was smiling."
Thank you.
Interlude 2. The Burning Hole. His nightmares were always the same. Abraham, old or young, naked and kneeling before the huge hole in the ground, the bodies burning below as a Nazi officer moved down the row of kneeling prisoners, shooting them in the back of the head. The burning hole was behind the infirmary in the extermination camp known as Treblinka. Prisoners too sick or too old to work were taken through the white-painted barracks with a red cross painted on it, and into the hole they went. Young Abraham saw many die there, but he himself came close to it only once. He tried to avoid notice, worked in silence, and kept to himself. Each morning he pricked his finger and smeared a drop of blood on each cheek in order to appear as healthy as possible at roll call. He first saw the hole while repairing some shelving in the infirmary. At age 16, Abraham Satrakian was a yellow patch, a craftsman. He curried no favor. He was no one's pet, merely a slave with a talent for woodwork that, in a death camp, was a talent for living. He had some value for the Nazi Hauptmann, who used him without mercy, without regard, and without end. He raised barbed wire fences, crafted a library set, repaired the railways. He carved elaborate pipes for the Ukrainian guard captain at Christmas time in 1942. It was his hands that Abraham kept away from the hole. At dusk, he could see its glow, and sometimes from his workshop, the smell of flesh and petrol mixed with sawdust. As his fear took hold of his heart, so did the hole take residence there. To this day, Satrakian still felt it in him, every time fear took hold, whether crossing a dark street, closing his shop at night, or upon waking from the nightmares, the tatters of his memories revived. Himself kneeling, naked, praying. In his dreams, he could feel the mouth of the gun pressing against his neck. Extermination camps had no function other than killing. Treblinka was disguised to look like a train station, with travel posters and timetables, and greenery woven into the barbed wire. He arrived there in September 1942 and spent all of his time working, earning his breath, he called it. He was a quiet man, young but well-raised, full of wisdom and compassion. He helped as many prisoners as he could and prayed in silence all the time. Even with the atrocities he witnessed daily, he believed that God was watching over all men. But one winter night, in the eyes of a dead thing, Abraham saw the devil and understood the ways of the world to be different from what he'd thought. It was past midnight, and the camp was as quiet as Satrakian ever saw it. The forest murmur had quieted down, and the cold air was splitting his bones. He shifted quietly in his bunk and gazed blindly at the darkness surrounding him, and then he heard it. Pick, pick, pick. Exactly as his Bubba had said. It sounded exactly as she'd said, and for some reason that made it all the more frightful. His breath vanished, and he felt in his heart the burning hole. In a corner of the barracks, the darkness moved. A thing, a towering, gaunt figure, peeled off from the inky depths and glided over his sleeping comrades. Pick, pick, pick. Sardieu, or a thing that once had been him. Its skin was shriveled and dark, blending with the fold of its dark, loose robes, much like an animated blotch of ink. The thing moved effortlessly, a weightless phantom gliding across the floor. Its talon-like toenails scraped the wood ever so softly. But it couldn't be. The world was real, evil was real, and surrounding him all the time. But this could not be real. This was a Bubba Meisa. A Bubba. Pick, pick, pick. In a matter of seconds, the long-dead thing reached the bunk across from Satrakian. Abraham could smell it now, dried leaves and earth and mold. He could see hints of its blackened face as it emerged from the bundled darkness of the body and leaned forward, smelling the neck of Zarowski, a young Pole, a hard worker. The thing stood the height of the barracks, its head among the beams above, breathing hard and hollowly, excited, hungry. It moved along to the next bunk, where its face was briefly outlined by the light of a nearby window. The darkened skin became translucent, like a sliver of dry meat against the light. It was all dry and matte, except for its eyes.
two gleaming spheres that seemed to glow intermittently, like lumps of burning coal catching a reanimating breath. Its dry lips drew back to reveal mottled gums and two rows of small, yellowed teeth, impossibly sharp. It paused above the frail form of Vladislav Zajec, an old man from Grodno, a late arrival, sickened with tuberculosis. Tetrakian had supported Zajec since his arrival, showing him the ropes and shielding him from scrutiny. His disease alone was reason enough for instant execution, but Tetrakian claimed him as his assistant and kept him away from the SS overseers and Ukrainian guards at critical times. But Zajec was gone now. His lungs were giving out, and more important, he had lost the will to live, shutting down, seldom speaking, constantly crying in silence. He had become a liability to Satrakian's survival, but his entreaties no longer inspired the old man, Satrakian hearing him shudder with silent coughing spasms and quietly sobbing until dawn. But now, towering above him, the thing observed Zajec. The rhythmic breathing of the old man seemed to please it. Like the angel of death, it extended its darkness over the man's frail body and clucked its dry palate eagerly. What the thing did then, Tetrakian could not see. There was a noise, but his ears refused to hear it. This great, gloating thing bent over the old man's head and neck. Something about its posture indicated a feeding. Zajac's old body twitched and spasmed ever so lightly, but remarkably, the old man never awoke and never did again. Tetrakian muffled a gasp with his hand, and the feeding thing didn't seem to mind him. It spent time over the various sick and infirm. By night's end, three corpses were left behind, and the thing looked flushed, its skin suppler, but equally dark. Tetrakian saw the thing fade away into the darkness and leave. Cautiously, he got up and moved next to the bodies. He looked them over in the faint light, and there was no sign of any trauma, other than a thin slit in the neck, a breach so thin as to be nearly imperceptible. If he hadn't witnessed the horror himself, then it dawned on him, this thing, it would return again, and soon. This camp was a fertile feeding ground, and it would graze on the unnoticed, the forgotten, the inconsequential. It would feed on them, all of them, unless someone rose up to stop it. Someone. Him. Movement. Coach. Flight 753 survivor Ansel Barber huddled with his wife Anne Marie and his two children, 8-year-old Benji and 5-year-old Haley, on a blue chintz sofa in the back sunroom of their 3-bedroom home in Flatbush, New York. Even Pap and Gertie got into the act, the two big St. Bernards allowed inside the house for this special occasion, so happy to see him home, their man-sized paws leaning on his knees and patting gratefully at his chest. Ansel had been seated in aisle seat 39G in coach, returning home from an employer-paid database security training session in Potsdam, southwest of Berlin. He was a computer programmer, embarking on a 4-month contract with a New Jersey-based retailer following the electronic theft of millions of customers' credit card numbers. He had never been out of the country before and had missed his family intensely. Downtime and sightseeing tours were built into the 4-day conference, but Ansel never ventured outside his hotel, preferring to remain inside his room with his laptop, talking to the kids via webcam, and playing Hearts over the internet with strangers. His wife, Anne Marie, was a superstitious, sheltered woman, and Flight 753's tragic end only confirmed her closely held fears of air travel and new experiences in general. She did not drive a car. She lived in the grip of dozens of borderline obsessive-compulsive routines, including touching and repetitively cleaning every mirror in the house, which reliably warded off bad luck. Her parents had died in an automobile accident when she was 4. She'd survived the crash, and she was raised by an unmarried aunt who passed away just 1 week before Anne Marie and Ansel's wedding. The births of her children had only intensified Anne Marie's isolation,
amplifying her fears to the point where she would often go days without leaving the safety of her own house, relying exclusively on Ansel for anything involving a transaction with the outside world. The news of the crippled airplane had brought her to her knees. Ansel's subsequent survival revived her with the power of an exaltation that she could define only in religious terms, a deliverance, confirming and consecrating the absolute necessity of her redundant, life-preserving routines. Ansel, for his part, was intensely relieved to be back home. Both Ben and Haley tried to pile on top of him, but he had to hold them off due to the lingering pain in his neck. The tightness, his muscles felt like ropes being torturously twisted, was centralized in his throat, but extended past the hinges of his jaw up to his ears. When you twist a rope, it shortens, and that was how his muscles felt. He stretched his neck, hoping for some chiropractic relief. Snap, crackle, pop, which nearly doubled him over. The pain wasn't worth the effort. Later, Anne-Marie walked in on him in the kitchen as he was replacing her economy-sized bottle of ibuprofen in the high cabinet over the stove. He popped 6 at once, the daily recommended dosage, and was barely able to get them down. Her fearful eyes drained of all cheer. "What is it?" "Nothing," he said, though he was in too much discomfort to shake his head. "But best not to worry her. Just stiffness from the plane. The way my head hung, probably." She remained in the doorway, pulling at her fingers. "Maybe you shouldn't have left the hospital." "And how would you have been able to get by?" he shot back, being shorter with her than he'd planned. Snap, crackle, pop. "But what if you have to go back in? What if this time they want you to stay?" It was exhausting having to dismiss her fears at the expense of his own. "I can't miss any work as it is. You know we're right on the edge with our finances." They were a one-income household in an America of two-income households, and Ansel couldn't take a second job, because then who would do the grocery shopping? She said, "You know, I couldn't get along without you." They never discussed her illness, at least never in terms of it being an illness. "I need you. We need you." Ansel's shoulder nod was more like a bow, dipping at his waist instead of his neck. "My God, when I think about all those people." He pictured his seatmates from the long flight, the family with 3 grown children, 2 rows in front of him, the older couple sitting across the aisle, sleeping most of the way, white-haired heads sharing the same travel pillow, the bleached blonde flight attendant who dripped diet soda on his lap. "Why me, you know? Is there some reason I survived?" "There is a reason," she said, her hands flat against her chest. "Me." Later, Ansel took the dogs back out to their backyard shed. The yard was the main reason they'd bought this house. Plenty of playroom for the kids and the dogs. Ansel had Pap and Gertie before he'd ever met Anne-Marie, and she had fallen in love with them at least as much as she had him. They loved her back, no conditions. As did Ansel, and as did the kids, although Benji, the older one, was starting to question her eccentricities here and there, especially when they caused a conflict with an 8-year-old's schedule of baseball practices and play dates. Already, Ansel could sense Anne-Marie pulling back from him a bit, but Pap and Gertie would never challenge her, so long as she kept overfeeding them. He feared for the kids as they grew up, feared that they might outgrow their mother at too early an age, and never truly understand why she might appear to favor the dogs over them. Inside the old garden shed, a metal fence pole was driven into the center floorboards, with 2 chains attached to it. Gertie had run off earlier that year, coming back with switch marks all over her back and legs, somebody having taken a whipping stick to her. So they chained up the dogs at night now, for their own protection. Ansel slowly, keeping his neck and head aligned, minimizing discomfort, set down their food and water, and then ran his hand over the tufts of their enormous heads as they ate, just making them real, appreciating them for what they were at the end of this lucky day. He went out and closed the door after chaining them to the pole, and stood looking at his house from the back, trying to imagine this world without him in it. Ansel had seen his children weep today, and he had wept with them. His family needed him more than anything. A sudden, piercing pain in his neck shook him. He grabbed for the corner of the dog shed in order to keep from falling over, and for several moments stood frozen like that, doubled over to one side, shivering and riding out this flaring, knifing pain. It passed, finally, leaving him with a seashell-like roaring in one ear. He probed his neck gently with his fingers, too tender to touch. He tried to stretch it, to improve his mobility, tipping his head back as far as he could toward the night sky. Airplane lights up there. Stars. I survived, he thought. The worst is over. This soon will pass. That night he had a horrifying dream. His children were being chased through the house by some rampaging beast, but when Ansel ran to save them, he found he had monster claws for hands. He woke up with his half of the bed soaked in sweat and climbed out quickly, only to be gripped by another seizure of pain. Snap! His ears, jaw, and throat were fused together by the same taut ache, leaving them unable to swallow. Crackle! The pain of that basic esophageal retraction was nearly crippling. And then there was the thirst, like nothing he had ever felt, an urge that would not stop. When he could move again, he walked across the hall and into the dark kitchen. He opened the fridge and poured himself a tall glass of lemonade, then another and another. And soon he was drinking straight from the pitcher, but nothing would quench the thirst. Why was he sweating so much? The stains on his nightshirt had a heavy odor, vaguely musky, and the sweat had an amber tint. So hot in here. As he placed the pitcher back in the fridge, he spotted a plate with marinating meat. He saw the sinuous strands of blood mixing lazily with oil and vinegar, and his mouth watered. Not at the prospect of grilling it, but at the idea of biting it, of sinking his teeth into it, and tearing it, and draining it, at the idea of drinking the blood. Pop. He wandered into the main hallway and took a peek at the kids. Benji was balled up under Scooby-Doo sheets. Haley was snoring softly, with her arm dangling off the side of her mattress, reaching for picture books that had fallen there. Seeing them allowed him to relax his shoulders and catch his breath a bit. He stepped out into the backyard to cool off, the night air chilling the dried sweat on his skin. Being home, he felt, being with his family could cure him of anything. They would help him. They would provide. Office of the Chief Medical Examiner, Manhattan. There was no blood on the medical examiner who met Eve and Nora. That alone was a strange sight. Normally it ran down their waterproof gowns and stained their plastic sleeves up to the elbows, but not today. The ME might as well have been a Beverly Hills gynecologist. He introduced himself as Gossett Bennett, a brown-skinned man with browner eyes, a purposeful face behind a plastic shield. "We're just getting underway here," he said, waving at the tables. The autopsy room was a noisy place. Whereas an operating room is sterile and silent, the morgue is its direct opposite, a bustling space, hectic with whining saws, running water, and dictating doctors. "We've got 8 going from your airplane." Bodies lay upon 8 guttered tables of cold stainless steel. The airline fatalities were in various stages of autopsy, 2 of them fully canoed. That is, their chests had already been eviscerated, the removed organs laid out on an open plastic bag on their shins, a pathologist paring away samples on a cutting board like a cannibal preparing a platter of human sashimi. The wounded necks had been dissected and the tongues pulled through, the faces folded halfway down like latex masks, exposing the skullcaps, which had been opened with a circular saw. One brain was in the process of being severed from its attachment to the spinal cord, whereupon it would be placed in a formalin solution to harden, the last step of an autopsy. A morgue attendant was standing by with wadding and a large curved needle threaded with heavy wax twine to refill the emptied skull. A long-handled pair of hardware store pruning shears was being passed from one table to the next, where another attendant stood on a metal footstool over an open-chested body and began cracking ribs one at a time so that the entire ribcage and sternum could be lifted out whole. The smell was an absorbing stew of Parmesan cheese, methane, and rotten eggs. "After you called, I began checking their necks," said Bennett. "All the bodies so far present the same laceration you spoke of, but no scar. An open wound, as precise and clean as any I've ever seen." He showed them to an undissected female body laid out on a table. A 6-inch metal block beneath her neck made her head fall back, arching her chest, extending her neck. Eef probed the skin over the woman's throat with his gloved fingers. He noticed the faint line, as thin as a paper cut, and gently parted the wound. He was shocked by its neatness as well as its apparent depth. Eef released her skin, and the breach closed lazily, like a sleepy eyelid or a timid smile.
"What could have caused this?" he asked. "Nothing in nature, not that I know of," said Bennett. "Notice the scalpel-like precision, almost calibrated, you might say, both in aim and length, and yet the edges around it, which is to say, almost organic in appearance."
"How deep?" asked Nora. "Clean breach, straight in, puncturing the wall of the common carotid, but stopping there, not going out the other side, not rupturing the artery."
"In every case?" gasped Nora.
"Everyone I've looked at so far. Every body bears the laceration. Though if you hadn't alerted me, I have to admit, I might not have noticed it, especially with everything else going on with these bodies."
"What else?"
"We'll get there in a moment. Each laceration is on the neck, either front or side, excluding one female who had hers on the chest, high above her heart, and one male we had to search and eventually found the breach on the upper inside thigh, over the femoral artery. Each wound perforated skin and muscle, ending exactly inside a major artery."
"A needle?" ventured Eef.
"But finer than that. I need to do more research into it. We're just at the beginning here, and there's plenty of other freaky shit going down. You're aware of this, I assume." Bennett led them to the door of the walk-in refrigerator. Inside, it was wider than a two-car garage. There were 50 or so gurneys, most containing a crash bag unzipped down to the corpse's chest. A handful were fully unzipped, those bodies nude, having already been weighed, measured, and photographed, and ready for the autopsy table. There were also 8 or so corpses unrelated to Flight 753, lying on bare gurneys without crash bags, bearing standard yellow toe tags. Refrigeration slows decomposition in the same way it preserves fruits and vegetables and delays cold cuts from spoiling. But the airplane bodies hadn't spoiled at all. 36 hours out, and they looked nearly as fresh as when Eef had first boarded the plane. As opposed to the yellow-tagged corpses, which were bloating, effluvium oozing from every orifice like a black purge, flesh going dark green and leather-like from evaporation.
"These are some pretty good-looking dead people," said Bennett.
Eef felt a chill that had nothing to do with the temperature in the cooler. He and Nora both waded in, 3 rows deep. The bodies looked not healthy, for they were shrunken and bloodlessly wan, but not long dead. They bore the characteristic mask of the deceased, but it was as though they had just passed over, not 30 minutes ago. They followed Bennett back out into the autopsy room, to the same female corpse, a woman in her early 40s with no distinguishing marks other than a decade-old cesarean scar below the bikini line, being prepped for incision. But instead of a scalpel, Bennett reached for a tool never used inside a morgue, a stethoscope. "I noticed this earlier," he said, offering the scope to Eef. Eef put in the earplugs, and Bennett called for everyone else in the room to stop for silence. A pathology assistant rushed around, turning off the running water. Bennett laid the acoustic end of the stethoscope against the corpse's chest, just below her sternum. Eef listened with trepidation, afraid of what he was to hear, but he heard nothing. He looked at Bennett again, who showed no expression, waiting. Eef closed his eyes and focused. Faint, very faint. A squirming sound, almost like that of something wriggling in mud. A slow sound, so maddeningly slight he couldn't be altogether certain he wasn't imagining it. He gave the scope to Nora to have a listen. "Maggots?" she said, straightening. Bennett shook his head. "In fact, there is no infestation at all, accounting in part for the lack of decay. But there are some other intriguing abnormalities." Bennett waved everyone else to return to their work, selecting from a side tray a big No. 6 blade scalpel. But instead of starting in on the chest with the usual Y-shaped incision, he took a large-mouth stock jar from the enameled counter and placed it beneath the corpse's left hand. He drew the scalpel blade abruptly across the underside of the wrist, slicing it open like the rind of an orange.
A pale, opalescent liquid sprayed at first, some of it spurting out onto his gloves and his hip on the initial cut, then sluicing steadily out of the arm, singing into the bottom of the jar. Flowing fast, but then lacking any circulatory pressure from its stilled heart, losing force after about 3 ounces or so. Bennett lowered the arm to draw out more. Eve's shock at the callousness of the cut was quickly overcome by his amazement at the sight of the flow. This couldn't be blood. Blood settles and congeals after death. It doesn't drain out like engine oil. Nor does it turn white. Bennett returned the arm to the corpse's side and held up the jar for F to see. Lieutenant, the corpses, they're... At first I thought maybe the proteins were separating the way oil sits on top of water, Bennett said. But it's not quite that either. The issue was pasty white, almost as though sour milk had been introduced into the bloodstream. Lieutenant! Oh, Jesus! Eve could not believe what he was seeing. Nora said, They're all like this? Bennett nodded. Exsanguinated. They have no blood. Eve eyed the white matter in the jar, and his taste for whole milk turned his stomach. Bennett said, I've got some other things. Core temperature is elevated. Somehow these bodies are still generating heat. Additionally, we found dark spots on some organs. Not necrosis, but almost more like bruising. Bennett set the jar of opalescent fluid back down on the counter and called over a pathology assistant. She brought with her an opaque plastic tube of the same sort that takeout soup comes in. She peeled off the top and Bennett reached inside, removing an organ, setting it on a cutting board like a small, fresh-from-the-butcher roast. It was an undissected human heart. He pointed a glove finger at where it would have joined the arteries. See the valves? Almost as if they have grown open. Now, they couldn't have operated like this in life, not closing and opening and pumping blood. So this can't have been congenital. Eve was aghast. This abnormality was a fatal defect. As every anatomist knows, people look just as different on the inside as they do on the outside. But no human being could conceivably have survived to adulthood with this heart. Nora asked, Do you have any medical records for the patient? Anything we can check this against? Nothing yet. Probably not until morning, but it's made me slow this process down, way down. I'm stopping in a little while, shutting down for the night so I can get some more support in here tomorrow. I want to check every little thing, such as this. Bennett walked them down to a fully anatomized body, that of a midweight adult male. His neck had been dissected, back to the throat, exposing the larynx and the trachea, so that the vocal folds or vocal cords were visible just above the larynx. Bennett said, See the vestibular folds? They were also known as false vocal cords, thick mucous membranes whose only function is to sit above and protect the true vocal folds. They are a true anatomical oddity in that they can regenerate themselves completely even after surgical removal. Eve and Nora leaned in closer. Both saw the outgrowth from the vestibular folds, a pinkish, fleshy protuberance, not disruptive or malformed like a tumorous mass, but branching from and within the inner throat, below the tongue. A novel, seemingly spontaneous augmentation of the soft lower mandible. They scrubbed up outside more diligently than usual. Both were deeply shaken by what they had seen inside the morgue. Eve spoke first. I'm wondering when things are going to start making sense again. He dried his hands completely, feeling the open air against his gloveless hands. Then he felt his own neck, over the throat, approximately where the incisions were all located. A straight, deep puncture wound in the neck, and a virus that slows antemortem decomposition on the one hand, yet apparently causes spontaneous antemortem tissue growth on the other. Nora said, This is something new. Or... Something very, very old. They started out the delivery door to Eve's illegally parked Explorer, his emergency blood delivery pass on the dash. The last streaks of daytime warmth were leaving the sky. Nora said, We need to check out the other morgues, see if they are finding the same deviations. The alarm went off on Eve's cell phone, a text message from Zach.
Where are you? Z.
Shit,
said Eve.
I forgot. Custody hearing.
Now? Nora said before catching herself. Okay, you go. I'll meet you after. No, no, I'll call them. It'll be fine. He looked around, feeling himself splitting in two. We need to take another look at the pilot. Why did this puncture close up, but not the others? We need to get on top of the physiopathology of this thing. And the other survivors? Eve frowned, reminded that they were gone. It's not like Jim to screw up like that. Nora wanted to defend Jim. If they're getting sick, they'll come back. Only it might be too late, for them and for us. What do you mean, for us? To get to the bottom of this thing? There's got to be an answer somewhere, an explanation, a rationale. Something impossible is happening, and we need to find out why and stop it. Up on the sidewalk at the main entrance on First Street, news crews were set up for live remotes from the medical examiner's office. That attracted a sizable crowd of onlookers, whose nervousness was palpable from around the corner. Lots of uncertainty in the air. But one man broke from the crowd, a man Eve had noticed on the way in. An old man with birch white hair, holding a walking stick that was too tall for him, gripping it like a staff, below its high silver handle. Like a dinner theater Moses, except that he was impeccably dressed, formal and old-fashioned, in a light black overcoat over a gabardine suit with a gold watch chain looped on his vest. And oddly, for the otherwise distinguished wardrobe, gray wool gloves with the fingertips cut off. Dr. Goodweather. The old man knew his name. Eve gave him another look and said, "Do I know you?" The man spoke with an accent, maybe Slavic. "I saw you on the box, the TV. I knew you would have to come here. You've been waiting here for me? What I have to say, doctor, is very important. Critical." Eve was distracted by the handle on top of the old man's tall walking stick, a silver wolf's head. "Well, not now. Call my office, make an appointment." He moved away, dialing rapidly on his cell phone. The old man appeared anxious, an agitated man striving to speak calmly. He put on his best, gentlemanly smile, including Nora in his introduction. "Abraham Satrakian is my name, which should mean nothing to you." He gestured with his walking stick at the morgue. "You saw them in there, the passengers from the airplane." Nora said, "You know something about that?" "Indeed," he said, sending a grateful smile her way. Satrakian glanced at the morgue again, like a man who, having waited so long to speak, was uncertain where to start. "You found them not much changed in there, no?" Eve turned off his cell phone before it rang through. The old man's words echoed his own irrational fears. "Not changed how?" he said. "The dead. Bodies not breaking down." Eve said, more out of concern than intrigue, "So that is what people are hearing out here?"
"No one had to tell me anything, doctor. I know."
"You know," said Eve. "Tell us," said Nora. "What else do you know?" The old man cleared his throat. "Have you found a coffin?" Eve felt Nora rise up almost 3 inches off the sidewalk. Eve said, "What did you say?"
"A coffin. If you have it, then you still have him."
Nora said, "Him? Who?"
"Destroy it. Right away. Do not keep it for study. You must destroy the coffin without delay."
Nora shook her head.
"It's gone," she said.
"We don't know where it is." Satrakian swallowed with bitter disappointment.
"It is as I feared."
"Why destroy it?" asked Nora. Eve cut in then, saying to Nora, "If this kind of talk is getting around, people will panic." He looked at the old man. "Who are you? How did you hear these things?"
"I am a pawnbroker. I heard nothing. These things I know."
"You know?" said Nora. "How do you know?"
"Please," he focused on Nora now, the more receptive one. "What I am about to say, I do not say lightly. I say it desperately and with utter honesty. Those bodies in there," he pointed at the morgue, "I tell you, before this night falls, they must be destroyed."
"Destroyed?"
said Nora, reacting negatively to him for the first time.
Why? I recommend incineration, cremation. It is simple and sure.
That's him, came a voice from the side doors, a morgue official leading a uniformed New York City patrolman toward them, toward Satrakian. The old man ignored them, speaking faster now.
Please, it is almost too late.
Right there, said the morgue official, marching over, pointing out Satrakian to the cop. That's the guy. The cop, amiable and bored, said to Satrakian, Sir. Satrakian ignored him, pleading his case directly to Nora and Eve.
A truce has been broken, an ancient sacred pact, by a man who is no longer a man, but an abomination. A walking, devouring abomination.
Sir, said the cop, may I have a word with you, sir? Satrakian reached out and grasped Eve's wrist to command his attention.
He is here now, here in the new world, this city, this very day, this night. Do you understand? He must be stopped.
The wool-covered fingers of the old man's hand were gnarled, claw-like. Eve pulled away from him, not roughly, but enough to jostle the old man backward. His walking stick whacked the cop on the shoulder, almost in the face, and suddenly the cop's disinterest turned to anger.
Okay, that's it, said the cop, twisting the walking stick out of his hands and bracing the old man's arm. Let's go.
You must stop him here,
Satrakian continued, being led away. Nora turned to the morgue official. What's this about? What are you doing? The official glanced at the laminated identification cards hanging from their necks, the red letters reading CDC before answering. He tried to get inside earlier, claiming to be a family member, insisting on viewing the dead bodies. The official looked at him being taken away, some kind of ghoul. The old man continued to plead his case.
Ultraviolet light, he called over his shoulder. Go over the bodies with ultraviolet light.
Eve froze. Had he just heard that?
Then you will see. I am right,
yelled the old man, being folded into the back seat of a cruiser.
Destroy them. Now, before it is too late.
Eve watched them slam the door on the old man, the cop climbing behind the wheel and pulling away. Excess baggage. Eve's call rang through 40 minutes late to his, Kelly's, and Zach's 50-minute session with Dr. Inga Kempner, their court-appointed family therapist. He was relieved not to be sitting inside her first-floor office in a pre-war brownstone in Astoria, the place where the final custody issues were to be decided. Eve pled his case through the doctor's speakerphone. Let me explain, I've been dealing all weekend with the most extreme of circumstances. This dead airplane situation out at Kennedy couldn't be helped. Dr. Kempner said, This isn't the first time you failed to present yourself at an appointment. Where's Zach? He said. Out in the waiting area, said Dr. Kempner. She and Kelly had been talking without him. Things had already been decided. It was all over, before it had even begun. Look, Dr. Kempner, all I ask is that you reschedule our appointment. Dr. Goodweather, I am afraid that...
No, wait, please, hold on. He cut right to it. Look, am I the perfect father?
No, I'm not, I admit that. Points for honesty, right? In fact, I'm not even sure I'd want to be the perfect father and raise some plain vanilla kid who's not going to make a difference in this world. But I do know that I want to be the best father I can be, because that is what Zach deserves, and that is my only goal right now. All appearances to the contrary, said Dr. Kempner. Eve gave his phone the finger. Nora stood just a few feet away. He felt angry, yet strangely exposed and vulnerable.
Listen to me, said Eve, fighting hard to keep his cool. I know that you know I have rearranged my life around this situation, around Zach.
I established this office in New York City specifically so that I could be here, near his mother, so that he would have the benefit of us both. I usually have very regular hours during the week, a dependable schedule with established off-call times. I'm working doubles on weekends in order to have two off for every one I'm on. Did you attend an AA meeting this weekend? Eve grew silent.
All the air went out of his tires. Were you even listening? Have you felt the need to drink?
No,
he grunted, making a supreme effort to keep his cool. I've been sober 23 months, you know that. Dr. Kempner said, Dr. Goodweather, this isn't a question of who loves your son more. It never is in these situations. Wonderful that you both care so much, so deeply. Your dedication to Zach is plainly evident. But as is so often the case, there seems to be no way to prevent this from turning into a contest. The state of New York issues guidelines I must follow in my recommendation to the judge. Eve swallowed bitterly. He tried to interrupt, but she kept on talking. You've resisted the court's original custodial inclination. You fought it every step of the way, and I consider that a measure of your affection for Zachary. You have also made great personal strides, and that is both evident and admirable. But now we find that you have reached your court of last resort, if you will, in the formulas we use for arbitrating custody. Visitation rights, of course, have never been in question.
No, no, no,
murmured Eve, like a man about to be rammed by an oncoming car. It was the same sinking feeling he'd had all weekend. He tried reaching back to he and Zach sitting in his apartment, eating Chinese food and playing video games. The entire weekend stretched out before them. What a glorious feeling that had been.
My point, Dr. Goodweather, said Dr. Kempner, is that I can't see much purpose in going any further.
Eve turned to Nora, who looked up at him, understanding in an instant what he was going through.
You can tell me it's over, Eve whispered into the phone. But it's not over, Dr. Kempner. It never will be.
And with that, he hung up. He turned away, knowing Nora would respect him in this moment and not try to approach, and for that he was grateful, because there were tears in his eyes that he did not want her to see. The first night. Just a few hours later, inside the basement morgue of the office of the chief medical examiner in Manhattan, Dr. Bennett was finishing up after a very long day. He should have been exhausted, but in fact he was exhilarated. Something extraordinary was happening. It was as though the normally reliable rules of death and decomposition were being rewritten right in this room. This shit went beyond established medicine, beyond human biology itself, perhaps even into the realm of the miraculous. As planned, he had halted all autopsies for the night. Some work continued on other matters, the medico-legal investigators operating out of the cubicles upstairs, but the morgue was Bennett's. He had noticed something during the CDC doctor's visit, something about the blood sample he had drawn, the opalescent fluid he had collected in a specimen jar. He had stored it in the back of one of the specimen coolers, stashing it behind some glassware, like the last good dessert, inside a community refrigerator. He unscrewed the cap and looked at it now, seated on a stool at the examination counter near the sink. After a few moments, the surface of the 6 or so ounces of white blood rippled, and Bennett shivered. He took a deep breath in order to collect himself. He thought about what to do, and then pulled an identical jar down from the shelf above. He filled it with the same amount of water and set the jars down side by side. He needed to make certain that the disturbance was not the result of vibrations from a passing truck or some such. He watched and waited. There it was again. The viscous white fluid rippled, he saw it, while the considerably less dense water surface did not undulate at all. Something was moving inside the blood sample. Bennett thought for a moment. He poured the water down the sink drain, and then slowly poured the oily blood from one jar into the other. The fluid was syrupy and poured slowly but neatly. He saw nothing pass through the thin stream. The bottom of the first jar remained lightly coated with the white blood, but he saw nothing there. He set the new jar down, and again he watched and waited. He did not have to watch very long. The surface undulated, and Bennett nearly leaped out of his stool. He heard a noise behind him then, a scratching or a rustling sound. He turned, made jumpy by his discovery. Overhead lamps shone down on the empty stainless steel tables behind him, every surface wiped down, the floor drains mopped clean.
the Flight 753 victims locked away inside the walk-in cooler across the morgue. Rats, maybe. There was nothing they could do to keep the vermin out of the building, and they had tried everything, in the walls, or beneath the floor drains. He listened for a moment longer, then returned to the jar. He poured the liquid from jar to jar again, this time stopping halfway. The amounts in each jar were roughly even. He set them underneath the overhead lamp and watched the milky surface for a sign of life. There it was, in the first jar, a plip this time, almost like that of a small fish nibbling at the surface of a cloudy pond. Bennett watched the other jar until he was satisfied, and then poured its contents down the drain. He then started over, again dividing the contents between the two glass vessels. A siren in the street outside made him sit up. It passed, and in what should have been the ensuing silence, he heard sounds again, movement-type sounds, behind him. Again he turned, feeling equal parts paranoid and foolish now. The room was empty, the morgue sterilized and still. Yet, something was making that noise. He stood from his stool, silently, turning his head this way and that, in order to get a fix on its source. His divining directed his attention to the steel door of the walk-in refrigerator. He took a few steps toward it, all his senses attuned. A rustling, a stirring, as though from inside. He had spent more than enough time down here not to be spooked by the mere proximity to the dead, but then he remembered the ante-mortem growth these corpses had exhibited. Clearly, these anxieties had prompted him to revert to the usual human taboos regarding the dead. Everything about his job flew in the face of normal human instinct, cutting open corpses, defiling cadavers, peeling faces back from skulls, excising organs and flaying genitals. He smiled at himself in the empty room, so he was basically normal after all. His mind playing tricks on him, probably a glitch in the cooling fans or something. There was a safety switch inside the cooler, a big red button in the event anyone ever got themselves stuck in there accidentally. He turned back to the jars, watching them, waiting for more movement. He was wishing he had brought his laptop down in order to record his thoughts and impressions. Plip. He had been ready for it this time, his heart leaping, but his body staying put. Still in the first jar. He poured out the other one and split the fluid a third time, approximately 1 ounce in each. As he did this, he thought he saw something ride the spill from the first jar to the second, something very thin, no more than an inch and a half in length, if indeed he saw what he thought he saw. A worm. A fluke. Was this a parasitic disease? There were various examples of parasites reshaping hosts in order to serve their own reproductive aspects. Was this the explanation for the bizarre after-death changes he had seen on the autopsy table? He held up the jar in question, swishing around the thinning white fluid underneath the lamplight. He eyed the contents carefully, closely, and yes, not once, but twice, something slithered inside, wriggled, wire-thin, and as white as its surroundings, moving very fast. Bennett had to isolate it, dip it in formalin, and then study it, and identify it. If he had this one, he had dozens, maybe hundreds, maybe who knows how many, circulating inside the other bodies in the... A sharp bang from the cooler shocked him, made him jerk up, jostling the jar from his hand. It fell to the counter, but did not shatter, bouncing instead, clattering into the sink, spilling and splattering its contents. Bennett let loose a string of obscenities, searching the stainless steel basin for the worm. Then he felt warmth on the back of his left hand. Some of the white blood had splattered on him and was now stinging his flesh, not burning, but mildly caustic, enough to hurt. He quickly ran cold water over it and wiped it off on his lab coat before it could damage his skin. He whirled around then, facing the cooler. The bang he had heard was certainly no electrical malfunction, but more like a wheeled stretcher banging into another wheeled stretcher. Impossible. And his ire rose again. His worm had just gone down the drain. He would get another blood sample and isolate this parasite. This discovery was his.
Still wiping his hand on the flap of his jacket, he went to the door and pulled on the handle, releasing the chamber's seal. A hiss of stale, refrigerated air breathed over him as the door opened wide. Joan Luss, after having released herself and the others from the isolation ward, hired a car to take her straight to the weekend home in New Canaan, Connecticut, of one of the founding partners of her law firm. She'd had the driver pull over twice so she could retch out the window, a combination of flu and nerves. But no matter. She was victim class and advocate now, a grieved party and crusading counselor, fighting for restitution for the families of the dead and for the four fortunate survivors. The white shoe firm of Cammons, Peters, and Lilly could be looking at 40% of the largest corporate claim payout ever, bigger than Vioxx, bigger even than WorldCom. Joan Luss, partner. You think you're doing all right in Bronxville until you drive out into New Canaan. Bronxville, Joan's home, is a leafy village in Westchester County, 15 miles north of Midtown Manhattan, 28 minutes by Metro North train. Roger Luss worked in international finance for Klum and Fairstein and traveled out of the country most weeks. Joan had traveled quite a bit, but had to pull back after the children were born because it didn't look good. But she missed it and had thoroughly enjoyed her previous week in Berlin at the Ritz-Carlton on the Potsdamer Platz. She and Roger, having grown so accustomed to hotel living, had emulated that very lifestyle in their home, with heated bathroom floors, a downstairs steam room, twice weekly fresh flower deliveries, 7 days a week landscaping, and of course, their housekeeper and laundress. Everything but turndown service and a suite on their pillows at night. Buying into Bronxville several years before, with its lack of new construction and forbiddingly high tax rate, had been a big step up for them. But now, having had a taste of New Canaan, where lead partner Dory Cammons lived like a feudal lord on a three-house estate complete with a fishing pond, horse stables, and equestrian track, Bronxville, on her way back, had struck her as quaint, provincial, even a little tired. Now home, she had just awakened after suffering through a tremulous late-afternoon nap. Roger was still in Singapore, and she kept hearing noises in the house. Noises that finally scared her awake. Restless anxiety. She attributed it to the meeting, perhaps the biggest meeting of her life. Joan emerged from her study, holding the wall on her way downstairs, coming into the kitchen as Neva, the children's wonderful nanny, was clearing away the dinner mess, running a damp cloth over the table crumbs. "Oh, Neva, I could have done that," said Joan, not meeting a word of it, walking right to the tall glass cabinet where she kept their medicine. Neva was a Haitian grandmother who lived in Yonkers, one town over. She was 60-something, but looked basically ageless, always wearing a long ankle-length floral dress and comfortable Converse sneakers. Neva was a much-needed calming influence in the Luss home. They were a busy bunch, what with Roger's traveling and Joan's long hours in the city, and the children's school and programs in between, everyone going in 16 different directions. Neva was the family rudder, and Joan's secret weapon in keeping the household running right.
"Joan, you don't look so good."
Joan and don't came out sounding like John and Don in Neva's island lilt. "Oh, I'm just a little run down." She popped some Motrin and two Flexerils and sat down at the kitchen island, opening house beautiful.
"You should eat," said Neva.
"Hurts to swallow," said Joan.
"Soup, then," decreed Neva, and set about getting it for her.
Neva was a mother figure for all of them, not just the children. And why shouldn't Joan have some mothering, too? God knows, her real mother, twice divorced, living in an apartment in Hialeah, Florida, wasn't up to the task. And the best part? When Neva's doting ways became too annoying, Joan could simply send her away on an errand with the kiddies. Best arrangement ever.
"I hear about that aeroplane."
Neva looked back at Joan from the can opener.
"No good. An evil thing."
Joan smiled at Neva and her adorable little tropical superstitions, the smile cut abruptly short by a sharp pain in her jaw. While the soup bowl rotated in the whirring microwave,
Neva came back to look at Joan, laying her roughened brown hand against Joan's forehead, exploring the glandular region of Joan's neck with gray-nailed fingers. Joan pulled back in pain.
"Swollen bad," Neva said.
Joan closed the magazine. "Maybe I should go back to bed."
Neva stood back, looking at her strangely.
"You should go back to hospital."
Joan would have laughed if she knew it wouldn't hurt. "Back to Queens?" "Trust me, Neva. I'm much better off here in your hands. Besides, take it from one who knows, that whole hospital thing was an insurance ploy on the airline's behalf, all for their benefit, not mine." As she rubbed her sore, swollen neck, Joan envisioned the impending lawsuit, and once again her spirit soared. She glanced around the kitchen. Funny how a house she had spent so much time and money redecorating and renovating could appear so suddenly shabby. Cameron's, Peter's, Lily, and Luss. The children entered the kitchen then, Keen and Audrey, whining about some toy-related incident. Their voices worked their way inside Joan's head such that she was seized by a commanding urge to backhand them each hard enough to send them flying halfway across the kitchen. But she managed to do what she always did, channeling her aggression toward her children into false enthusiasm, thrown up like a wall around her angry self. She closed the magazine and raised her voice in order to silence theirs. "How would you each like a pony and your very own pond?" She believed it was her generous bribe that had silenced the children, but it was, in fact, her smile, gargoyle-like and glaring, bearing an expression of utter hatred that frightened them into stillness. For Joan, the momentary silence was bliss. The 911 call came in for a naked man at the Queens Midtown Tunnel exits. The dispatch went out as a 1050, a low-priority, disorderly person call. A unit from the 17 arrived within 8 minutes and found a bad jam-up, worse than usual for a Sunday night. A few drivers honked and pointed them uptown. The suspect, they yelled, a fat guy wearing nothing but a red tag on his toe, had already moved on. "I got kids here," howled one guy in a dinged-up Dodge Caravan. Officer Karn, the driver, said to his partner, Officer Lupo, "I'm going to say Park Avenue type, sex club regular. Took too much X before his weekend kink session." Officer Lupo unbuckled and opened his door. "I'm on traffic duty. Lover boy's all yours." "Thanks a lot," said Officer Karn to the slamming of the door. He lit up his rack and waited patiently. He wasn't paid extra to rush, for the traffic snarl to part for him. He cruised up past 38th, eyeballing cross streets. A fat, naked guy on the loose shouldn't be too hard to find. People on the sidewalk seemed okay, not freaked.